From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
The American people do not want the mosque there. And, of course, Muslims do not want us to burn the Quran.
That's Terry Jones, the pastor of a tiny Florida congregation, pulling the plug Thursday on his scheduled holy book burning after having ignited a global firestorm. He didn't do it alone, of course. He had help. Here's Fox News anchor Brett Baer.
As we told you at the top of the newscast, a Florida pastor has canceled plans to burn copies of the Quran Saturday. Tonight's text-to-vote poll question, whom do you think is most responsible for the escalation of this controversy? You can text your answer to 36288. Type SR1 for Reverend Terry Jones, SR2 for the Obama administration, or SR3 for the news media.
The Obama administration? The president waited until Thursday to call Jones's action a recruitment bonanza for al-Qaeda after his commander in Afghanistan spoke of heightened danger to the troops and his secretary of state said this.
We are hoping that the pastor decides not to do this. We're hoping against hope that if he does, it won't be covered.
Finally, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates called Jones up and probably helped talk him down. No, the White House is not a viable blame option. But I have no quarrel with the other choices offered by Fox's Brett Baer. Jones himself? The media? You think?
Mark Saturday's anniversary of September 11th. The Vatican and Sarah Palin have joined those speaking out against the planned protest. The White House is...
That from CBS TV News New York. The media, awash in controversy over the so-called Ground Zero Mosque and other incidents of Muslim baiting, smelled a pungent parable in the pastor's tale, not just because book burning is sensationally creepy, but because of what he represented. So what should the media have done with the pastor? As the week wore on, many mainstream news outlets made public avowals of their intention to cover the story with an emphasis on context and a strict limit on visuals. Fox News said it wouldn't cover it at all. The AP declared that its policy is not to cover, quote, events that are gratuitously manufactured to provoke and offend, which obviously this was. Pastor Jones.
We feel that a radical message is necessary. We also want to send a message to the moderate Muslim to stay peaceful and moderate. We expect the Muslims that are here in America to respect, honor, obey, submit to our Constitution.
Under our Constitution, people have the right to brazenly misconstrue our Constitution, just as pastors can unabashedly misinterpret the Bible.
If you look at Jesus's life, most of the time, he was very nice and very patient and very loving, but there was also times that Jesus did radical things. So I think Jesus would not run around burning books, but I think he would burn this one.
Actually, this story wasn't just about politics and intolerance. It was also, at its heart, a proxy argument among a wide range of ruminating or saliva-spewing talking heads over our Constitution. Small wonder America's freedoms of speech and religion are so often misunderstood abroad, given the muddled debate that dominates the media here.
No one who's interested in maintaining harmony and peace among different sections of the people can condone such action.
Like other officials around the world, Indian Minister of Home Affairs P. Chidambaram seems mystified by the fact that our government's hands are tied, and that's the way we like it.
We hope that the U.S. authorities will take strong action to prevent such an outrage being committed.
Though generally unacknowledged, most journalists here are guided by what's called the sphere of consensus. What is commonly held to be outside that sphere is rarely heard. There was a time when moral condemnation of slavery was outside that sphere. But now, with so many people producing media, the contours of acceptable speech have grown indistinct. We reap the whirlwind of unbounded freedom of the press, which is now virtually indistinguishable from freedom of speech. We say our enemies hate our freedoms, but sometimes we seem to hate them too. As you'll hear in a minute, reports of the pastor's plan reverberated across the Middle East weeks before it made a ripple here. So did the American fracas that followed, generating much wonderment and confusion. The fallout from the pastor's tale abroad is a real story, but it wasn't created by our media. It is, in a sense, about our media.
While media fervor over Pastor Terry Jones' Burn a Koran Day reached a crescendo in America this week, political science professor and foreign policy blogger Mark Lynch says that the Arab world has been following the story for more than a month. According to Lynch, this story, along with the ongoing argument over the Park 51 Community Center in Lower Manhattan, has poisoned the well of mainstream Muslim opinion towards the U.S., and undermined our attempts at Middle East diplomacy.
This story really only hit American media, you know, a few days ago, maybe when General Petraeus weighed in. But it's been a big issue over in the Arab media for weeks. And in the middle of August, you got condemnations of the pastor by Al-Azhar University in Cairo and by the Muslim World League in Mecca. And those generated huge amounts of commentary and discussion in the jihadist forums, in the TV stations, everywhere. And it's really feeding some of the worst stereotypes that are being pushed by extremists in the Middle East.
You mentioned extremists, and I want to ask you about that. I'm curious what jihadi forums have had to say, mainly because it seems to me that had this pastor not decided to burn the Quran, but instead decided to do a walkathon for leukemia, the jihadists wouldn't be any less condemning of anything American. Does burning a Quran change their worldview in any way?
No, not in the slightest. For the extremists, this is material to be used. The impact is on the mainstream. You know, they look at this kind of thing and it starts to raise questions. It really undermines a lot of the things both the Bush administration and the Obama administration have been trying to get out there. At the same time, you do have a certain number of columnists who are pointing to the existence of the debate. And I think some of the statements that are being made by our top politicians and officials, like Mayor Bloomberg, that's having a real effect also in terms of showing that there's some real diversity in American opinion.
And the willingness to tolerate even the most obnoxious speech.
There's less of a First Amendment kind of argument resonating over there. It's more the idea that America is not a monolith. You've got Al-Qaeda and extremist groups who are trying to claim that what's going on is that the West is at war with Islam. And when you have very prominent, influential voices saying that this is not what America stands for, that we repudiate this, that we condemn it, that really does help to disrupt the narrative that Al-Qaeda and people like that are trying to put forward.
This is an expression of American freedom and, in a way, pluralism. And just as this guy is free to set fire to a book, others are free to say what they will and practice religions as they will. Tell me again why this isn't an ad for why America is good.
The thing to remember is that this doesn't happen in a vacuum. This has become a major story in the aftermath of the controversy around the mosque in New York and what's widely seen as this rising wave of anti-Islam agitation across the United States. So there's a wider context here, and that's the reason that this guy in Florida, people are receiving him as simply one more manifestation of this wider issue.
Is there any sense in what you're reading that this obscure pastor represents the mainstream of American sentiment?
That's the real problem, is that all of these different things blur together. You might see people who were very public faces of the protests against the mosque in New York who are now speaking out against the burning of the Quran. But that doesn't really break through, because for many people who are both in the Arab media and who are consuming the Arab media, it all bleeds together. These are all different aspects of this rising anti-Islamic sentiment in the United States.
You know, I get that various incidents like this can ignite outrage throughout the Muslim world. But once again, I seem to be missing the outrage, not over burning books, but about violence that is perpetrated in Islam's name. On the anniversary of 9/11, are you seeing any evidence of lingering outrage about that?
This is one of those things which I see as an absolute tragedy, because if you look at the broad trends over the last few years, Al-Qaeda has been increasingly marginal in the Arab world. You've seen growing denunciations of violent extremism from across the political spectrum. You could have imagined this being a moment when the sorts of things that you're asking about, all of that had the opportunity to be there. Unfortunately, because of the events of the last month or two, the frame through which this year's 9/11 is going to be interpreted is going to be almost entirely this frame of anger and frustration over what they see as rising anti-Islam extremism.
So the controversies have usurped introspection.
It really has. And a lot of the gains that have been made over the last few years under Bush and Obama, you know, they really do risk just being swept away by this escalating anger. So I don't think it's a coincidence that you see national security officials from last administration and this one really stepping forward and saying, you know, this is really becoming a problem for us.
All right, Mark, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Mark Lynch is Associate Professor of Political Science and International Affairs at George Washington University and a blogger for Foreign Policy magazine.
Coming up, the government says a laptop is the same as a suitcase at the border, so make sure your digital underwear is clean.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from American Jewish World Service, pursuing global justice through grassroots change at ajws.org. The Kauffman Foundation, educating entrepreneurs about how to start and grow businesses through Kauffman Fast Track at fasttrack.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to help reverse the childhood obesity epidemic at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Whether they are publicity stunts or demonstrations of America's pluralistic freedom to mouth off, these recent Islam-related controversies seem to be amplifying anti-Muslim harassment. According to the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE, at the beginning of this year, there was about one incident per month of vandalism or arson perpetrated against mosques in the U.S. Now they say they're seeing roughly 12 incidents a month. So, in the heated context of the controversy over the so-called Ground Zero Mosque, the threat of Floridian Quran burning, and the anniversary of September 11th, CARE has decided to step up its PR efforts by producing public service announcements showing American Muslims reflecting on how 9/11 affected them.
My name is Rudy. I'm a clinical pharmacist, a first responder in 9/11, and a Muslim.
Corey Saylor is the legislative director of CARE.
We felt it was really important to do something that would humanize Muslims to our fellow Americans, and then also remind everybody that on 9/11, Al-Qaeda attacked the United States, not Islam. And while Al-Qaeda was murdering Americans, they also murdered 32 Muslims. And among those responding to the attacks were a number of Muslims. So we wanted to feature those stories.
Why do you think the media feature extremists?
Well, I think that's unfortunately what's going to get most people to watch or listen to the programming. I mean, let's face it, when I'm sitting around with a number of Christians and Jews talking about interfaith and how we can do good things together, that's not going to gather the same amount of attention as some guy waving a sword and screaming horrible things about America.
Exactly. I hate to say, what the moderate voices need to do is condemn constantly the extremist voices. Condemnation is not generally a moderate position, but that's the conundrum you face.
But that is the interesting thing. See, I think we've condemned so much, we've definitely proven who we are not. And the idea behind these PSAs is to start showing who we really are. And, you know, in one of those PSAs, you do see a man who was responding to 9/11 and learned that one of his friends was killed in 9/11.
When my friend came up to me and told me that Sean Powell was on the list, I took out my phone and I called him. That's really when it hit me and I was like, okay, this is real.
I'm a New York City firefighter
and I responded to 9/11. And I am a Muslim.
And he has a very human response to it, and it's just important for people to remember.
The first two PSAs have the first responders in them. The third one deals with the right to freedom of religion.
The ability to practice our religion.
If we don't have our rights,
it's at the heart of American freedom.
You don't have your rights.
Salam.
Peace.
Do you really think that this message can persuade anyone that we have all this in common when there's such a chasm growing between Islam and many people in the U.S.?
Absolutely. And we have proof of that in the history of the United States. I mean, you go back to before the Civil War, it was Irish and Catholics that everyone was suspicious of. World War II, Japanese Americans were put in internment camps, and they were eventually able to show everyone that they are Americans just like everyone else. They care about the same values. It just happens to be our turn, and the Muslim community is, I think, quite capable of proving we are just like everyone else and we have the same American values as everyone else.
I'm just wondering whether this is the best use of your money. Far be it from me to advise you, but pop culture tends to lead to increasing tolerance. Sympathetic sitcom depictions of minorities and gays tend to serve as a kind of wedge, a kind of ersatz familiarity with the unknown other. Instead of making PSAs, shouldn't you be buying some Hollywood writers an expensive lunch?
These PSAs, I believe they're a very good investment in our resources, but that doesn't mean this is the only path that we're pursuing. We do have an office in Hollywood, and they do work with various media outlets. I'll be very honest with you, one reality lately is that we don't have time to slow down and really think things through in the best manner. Those PSAs went from being conceived to being distributed in a week and a half.
Wow.
And, you know, it's just the last couple of months since this whole thing in Lower Manhattan got going, it's interview after interview after interview, meeting after meeting after meeting, and nobody really has time to look at the broader picture. It's deal with the daily fires.
Corey, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Corey Saylor is the legislative director of CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, and we will link to those PSAs.
On Tuesday, the American Civil Liberties Union filed suit against the Department of Homeland Security, charging that the detention and search of laptops, cell phones, and other electronic devices at the border without reasonable suspicion violates constitutional rights to privacy and free speech, in addition to protection from unlawful search and seizure. It's the latest attempt to challenge the government's assertion that a laptop is no different than a suitcase, at least at the border. DHS Secretary Janet Napolitano backs this controversial Bush-era practice, saying that it is, quote, consistent with the department's constitutional authority to search other sensitive non-electronic materials, such as briefcases, backpacks, and notebooks at U.S. borders. One of the three plaintiffs in this case is Pascal Abdour, a graduate student in Islamic studies at McGill University in Montreal. According to Catherine Crump of the ACLU, Abdour was searched on his way home to Brooklyn to visit his mom on Mother's Day.
The agent asked him what he studied and where he had been in the last couple of years, and he had been to the Middle East. And on the basis of that information, the border agent required him to gather up his things, took him to the cafe car of the train, noticed he had a laptop, required him to enter his password into the laptop, and then proceeded to start looking through his personal files. She noticed that he had pictures of Hamas rallies and other things in the Middle East and asked him about it. Pascal explained that he studied Shiite movements in modern Lebanon, and he ended up getting handcuffed, frisked, hauled off the train, and held for 3 hours and questioned. He was ultimately allowed to leave the border, but the border agents kept his laptop and proceeded to search through it for another 11 days. And when he looked to see what the border agents had gone through, he was able to tell that they'd accessed things such as records of internet conversations he's had with his girlfriend.
It seems most likely that the suspicion was raised because of the nature of the photographs that Abdour had in his laptop. Suddenly, this border agent was on, you know, a higher alert. And I guess his answers didn't satisfy her, which may or may not be disgraceful, but certainly is understandable. Is your concern how much deeper they dug once they got the laptop in their hands?
We have a number of concerns. First of all, the mere fact that Mr. Abidor was studying Islamic studies and had traveled to the Middle East isn't reasonable suspicion that he was engaged in wrongdoing, and so the initial search of his laptop shouldn't have happened. What's on your laptop is a great deal of sensitive information that's generally protected by the First Amendment. In ordinary life, if the government wants to get access to your personal correspondence or your home office, they have to get a warrant based on probable cause because the information is so sensitive. And even at the border, we think because of the sensitive nature of that information, the government needs to have at least reasonable suspicion before it can start reading through all of your personal papers.
The threshold for intrusion by federal agents at the border is much lower than it is within the country itself. How much lower is that?
The standards are lower at the border, but it's not a constitution-free zone. The court has held previously that where a search is particularly intrusive, the government has to show reasonable suspicion. So our argument in this case is that because of the expressive nature of materials on laptops and cell phones, those searches are particularly intrusive and trigger the reasonable suspicion requirement. In addition, the government now asserts that the border extends 100 miles into the country and that it is free to conduct border searches in that area. Criminal defense lawyers cross the border all the time with sensitive attorney-client privileged information, and it really impedes their ability to do their job if they have to struggle between going overseas to gather facts that they need to conduct investigations on the one hand and maintaining attorney-client privilege on the other.
Matthew Chandler, the Deputy Press Secretary for the Department of Homeland Security, gave us a statement that read in part, quote, "Searches of laptops and other electronic media during secondary inspection are a targeted tool that Customs and Border Protection uses in limited circumstances to ensure that dangerous people and unlawful goods do not enter our country."
No one is disputing that the government has the right to engage in border searches. The question here is whether they have the right to do so whenever they want for any reason.
Now, the DHS spokesman, immediately after declining to discuss pending litigation, offered legal precedents for this litigation, ones that did uphold the government's right to treat hard drive contents as if they were paper documents.
Those cases were litigated where criminal defendants were trying to suppress evidence that they possessed child pornography. And we're optimistic that in our case, where we represent journalists and criminal defense attorneys and other people who are very sympathetic and who have been really harmed by these searches, that courts will see things differently and recognize that searching through the contents of someone's paper is fundamentally different than searching through someone's shoes and their luggage.
Well, Catherine, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Catherine Crump is an attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union.
The idea was so appealing, a simple bit of software passed around Samizdat style in Iran that would allow activists to get online and do three things under the noses of Iranian authorities. First, send tightly encrypted messages. Second, access any website, even censored ones. And third, and most important, hide their activities within perfectly innocuous material like family photos or the homepage of weather.com. Well, last summer, that idea seemed to have become a reality when software designer Austin Heap, inspired by the unfolding post-election Iranian protests, set about to solve the problems plaguing internet-savvy Iranians. He named his creation Haystack, and it quickly became a made-for-media story of ingenuity made manifest. We spoke to Heap in May, shortly after he got fast-tracked U.S. government permission to distribute Haystack within Iran. This is what he told us.
It's always going to be a cat-and-mouse game. Haystack is the first anti-censorship tool to A, encrypt and protect the data, and B, hide it. I do expect them to attempt to reverse engineer the software and try to come up with ways to block it. And what we have done is come up with a roadmap for our next series of steps. So once there is something that potentially could block Haystack, we're ready to move to the next strategy and the next one.
The strategy seemed to be working according to the many articles and profiles of Heap and Haystack. But in the last few weeks, foreign policy contributing editor Yevgeny Morozov has raised serious questions about Haystack, arguing that Heap has beguiled the press with a story that was too good to check.
So far, it has only been used by 100 people in Iran, and the Iranian government has no incentive to track its users, and it has no incentive to do anything about Haystack because it's only used by 100 people.
Which is interesting, because you were first worried that an insufficiently tested or peer-reviewed system was in wide use in Iran, and then you were relieved to learn that it's really just a small group of beta testers who can protect themselves, but you still feel like the press was led down a garden path.
The claims that are posted on Haystack's website that it's a secure technology which uses state-of-the-art encryption are still there. You know, so it's either that Haystack provides its testers with a completely different set of answers to questions about security, or that the testers may actually be misled into thinking that the technology is more secure than it really is.
How sure are you that Haystack doesn't work?
No independent third party has managed to come up with an opinion that would assure us of Haystack's ability to do what it claims. You know, it's like me saying that, you know, the brakes on this car work, but I won't let any third party engineers test it, and you have to take me at my word, and why don't you drive it?
You have talked to some experts who have had direct experience with Haystack, right?
Well, I did. Some people actually managed to test it in Iran. They were not extremely impressed with how it managed to circumvent censorship. They did not manage to test how exactly secure it is. I spoke to a few people who have seen Haystack in the United States. Again, their conclusion was that it's a technology that needs further review and has a lot of room for improvement.
The Guardian newspaper gave Austin Heap the Innovator of the Year Award. You think you should have gotten the Publicist of the Year Award. And besides Heap, you basically hold two parties responsible for the uncritical touting of Haystack. The first, you say, is the U.S. government, which granted Heap permission to distribute Haystack within Iran. And you say this confers on Haystack a degree of legitimacy that it hasn't earned. That's not Heap's fault, or is it?
That's not Heap's fault. That's why I'm blaming the U.S. government. But, you know, there are several government agencies involved. So there is the U.S. Treasury Department, Department of Commerce. There was also involvement from the U.S. State Department. The U.S. Department of Treasury and Commerce assessed whether it may end up being used by the government of Ahmadinejad, how much damage it can cause to American interests.
Not a good housekeeping seal, merely a sign that it isn't going to hurt us.
Yes, and I would also like to add that the decision by the U.S. State Department, on the other hand, to somehow fast-track Haystack's application and to publicize it, including in one of Hillary Clinton's speeches, is something that I find a little bit more dubious because indirectly it would hurt Haystack's users in a country as sensitive as Iran.
The other guilty party here is us, and by us, you do mean us, among everybody else in the media. We aired an interview with Heap back in May, and we were quite impressed with his story. You say that Heap has proved to be catnip for the media. Why do you think his narrative is so appealing?
There is a lot of enthusiasm. You know, I would even call it some kind of irrational exuberance over the role that technology played in the Iranian protests in 2009. The media were full of stories about Iran's Twitter revolution. It really made for a very catchy narrative. I am 99% sure that no journalists who wrote about Haystack ever even saw a copy of Haystack. So far, most of the stories in the media seem to imply that this is a piece of software which exists, that it's functioning, that it's already being used by Iranians, while in fact it was a very raw piece of code.
Do you think the mainstream media's major problem with covering this new communications technology and all of its manifestations is that the mainstream media are just too starry-eyed or just too incompetent to assess it?
Well, I'll shock you, but I'll say both.
I am shocked.
The competence issue, I think, is obvious. It's this particular case of Haystack, you know, requires not only very deep knowledge of technology and how encryption works and, you know, how you can actually break encryption. It also requires a very deep knowledge of law, of regulations, how expert sanctions work. That said, there is definitely a degree of what I call cyber utopianism in the mainstream media coverage of technology. There is just too much unthinking admiration of what Facebook or Twitter, those technologies do, without necessarily paying close scrutiny to how they can also endanger the users, put them at risk, and about their long-term effects on political activism and dissent altogether.
Yevgeny, thank you very much.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Yevgeny Morozov is a contributing editor to Foreign Policy and a visiting scholar in the program on liberation technology at Stanford University. We made numerous attempts to reach Austin Heap to invite him to speak with us. He didn't respond.
Coming up, in the wake of Katrina, two emerging styles of reporting took center stage and never left.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. As the floodwaters of Hurricane Katrina receded 5 years ago this month, they exposed the corruption and incompetence of a local government that had failed its people. The resulting civic outrage galvanized a growing number of citizen journalists in New Orleans to help reclaim the city for the people who remained. As Nathan Rothstein wrote in the current issue of Good magazine, some of the most exciting reporting in New Orleans has been the result of independent voices, alone or in partnership with traditional media. Nathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You worked for several years on post-Katrina recovery projects and got a pretty good sense of the media ecology of New Orleans. Tell me first about the relationship between bloggers and organizations like the Times-Picayune, which did award-winning coverage in the wake of Katrina.
I think citizens around the city were happy with a good amount of the coverage that different issues were getting in the Times-Picayune, but since the stakes were very high, where there were problems with housing, there was problems with the criminal justice system, there were problems in education, and there were so many neighborhood meetings, city meetings, that the Times-Picayune could not possibly be at every single one. But with the invention of blogs and new media, people, if they see a problem, they can report it right away. So the bloggers were able to be the first line, and then the Times-Picayune could broadcast to a much wider audience.
I want to ask you about the redevelopment map that was brought to the attention of New Orleans citizens and the traditional media by a blogger. Tell me about it.
So right after the storm, the mayor hired the Urban Land Institute to develop a plan and then put together a commission, the Bring New Orleans Back Commission, made up of mostly wealthy business people in the city. And they held a series of meetings, but most of it was done behind closed doors. Well, in January of 2006, New Orleanians woke up to a map of their city with green dots over primarily African-American areas and also Broadmoor, which was pretty mixed. And when you don't tell people something, they assume the worst. So people assumed, and probably correct in this assumption, that this space was going to be turned maybe into green space.
Redlining with green dots, in other words.
Yeah. So they started turning to blogs, and they started coming out in large, large numbers to city planning meetings. And when people started reading this and listening to these people voice their concerns, they felt that something needed to change. And the Rockefeller Foundation stepped in and put about $7 million into a new plan that called for a citizen engagement process. So the first meeting had over 500 people there, and people were waiting in line to get in. So New Orleans saw a new type of activism and citizen engagement post-Katrina, partly because there was a disconnect between what citizens wanted and what the city, state, and federal government wanted to do.
That's an amazing story. It's not necessarily the most amazing. There was an example of a blogger whose name, I believe, is Karen Gadbois, who had been taking photographs of the many, many untold numbers of blighted properties around town and blundered upon a story. Tell me that story and how it played out.
Thousands and thousands of volunteers for a lot of the relief organizations did gutting work. So that meant that they came down to the city, they went into a house, and they went at the sheetrock. They tore it off the stubs, and then they did mold remediation. And the city also had a smaller department for mostly elderly citizens to help with their gutting. So if they couldn't get onto a volunteer list, the city would contract with a series of contractors to do that work. So Karen started looking through it, and she started seeing that properties that were on the city's gutted list had not been touched. The city had paid people to do work that was not being done. She had also connected with Lee Zurich, who at the time worked for WWL-TV, the CBS affiliate.
He was a TV anchor.
Correct. And he wanted to make sure that it was valid, because if they did go after it, his name was on the line. So he first actually did a story on Karen, on her work, and making sure the city was preserving homes that should be preserved and demolishing houses that needed to be demolished. And then they started to go into the stories that she was uncovering. And almost every weekend they did these stories. And finally, the federal government stepped in and closed down the office in, I think, late July of 2008. So this started from a citizen journalist, trickled up to the traditional media, and then led to a federal investigation. And that was a pattern that you can see across the city.
I want to ask you one last thing. The Big Easy and the state of Louisiana in general are notorious for political corruption. I want to ask you about Karen Gadbois. Her investigative journalism site is called The Lens, and The Lens for now has funding from a national foundation. But when that runs out, does she have any reason to expect that she'll be able to go into the New Orleans community and come away with money to do yet more digging?
There are some people who have money in New Orleans who care a lot about good government practices, and they have a vested interest in Karen and her organization being a watchdog for city government. And David Simon, who's spent a lot of time in New Orleans, recently did a fundraiser for The Lens, and he talks about its importance.
This is the TV producer, creator of Tremé on HBO.
Someone like that gets other people on board, and they're seeing how having journalism like that really helps city government find priorities in their work. And what the blogs provide is a voice from citizens, so people at City Hall are able to see this and hopefully build programs that work for all people.
Nathan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nathan Rothstein is a graduate student in nonprofit management at Brandeis University. His article about the influence of new media in New Orleans is in the summer 2010 issue of Good magazine.
When Hurricane Katrina burst through New Orleans' flawed levee system and flooded the city, supplies and rescuers were slow in coming. Casualties mounted and survivors suffered, most visibly at the New Orleans-appointed shelter, the Superdome. But the media were quick on the scene. 2 days after landing on the Gulf Coast, CNN's Anderson Cooper spoke with Louisiana Senator Mary Landrieu.
Excuse me, Senator, I'm sorry for interrupting. I haven't heard that because for the last 4 days, I've been seeing dead bodies in the streets here in Mississippi, and to listen to politicians thanking each other and complimenting each other, you know, I got to tell you, there are a lot of people here who are very upset and very angry and very frustrated, and when they hear politicians slap, you know, thanking one another, it just, you know, it kind of cuts them the wrong way right now, because literally, there was a body on the streets of this town yesterday being eaten by rats. Because this woman had been laying in the street for 48 hours, and there's not enough facilities to take her up. Do you get the anger that is out here?
As 24-hour cable news covered the story, Cooper's frustration and sadness and anger spread to other broadcasters, used to projecting cool resolve even when delivering the worst of news. But this time, it was different. And while it may have been uncharacteristic, it was also undeniably cathartic. The people on the screen vented our mounting anger, attempting to cut through politicians' spin, imploring them to do something. On the sixth day of New Orleans flooding, Fox's Shepard Smith reacted in a way reminiscent of what was once cinema's satirical extreme, Network's Howard Beale.
Over there, there's hope. Over there, there's electricity. Over there, there's food and water. But you cannot go from there
right,
to
Shep,
there.
I think
the government will not allow you to do it. It's a fact.
I want to get some perspective here, because earlier today, the images
that
were...
That is perspective.
Hang on a second.
That is all the perspective you need.
The depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street, all I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
5 years later, the impact of Katrina and Katrina reporting is still reverberating. Think of the coverage of Haiti. Did Katrina mark a transformation in TV news? Missouri State Assistant Professor of Journalism Andrew Klein joins us. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So we had this premise that Shepard Smith's emotional outburst during Katrina signaled some kind of ripening of a new kind of advocacy journalism, a kind of emotional advocacy for audience members. And you were a little skeptical. So you went back and you listened to Edward R. Murrow reporting from The Blitz and from Buchenwald.
Well, I was working on just, you know, memory because, you know, it had been a long time since I'd heard it. And I went back and listened and I was a little surprised to see, well, no, he wasn't too terribly emotional. He was a little melodramatic in the way they were at that time.
In another part of the camp, they showed me the children, hundreds of them. Some were only six. One rolled up his sleeve, showed me his number. It was tattooed on his arm. D-6030 it was. The others showed me their numbers. They will carry them till they die.
But what he was very pointed and very clear.
I should think in a few minutes there may be a bit of shrapnel around here. Coming in, moving a little closer all the while. Just overhead now, the burst of the anti-aircraft fire. Now you'll hear two bursts a little nearer in a moment. There they are.
Basing it on really good reporting and observation, but no overt emotionalism.
So why did you remember it emotionally?
Well, those are emotional things. I mean, you know, if you're on a rooftop and you're being bombed, or that you are among the first to enter the gates at Buchenwald and seeing the horrors there, any human being is going to be moved to emotion that maybe they can't contain.
This, of course, was radio, which was the most immediate communication of the day, but was eclipsed soon after by TV. So you also reviewed some particularly poignant moments of early TV coverage, such as Walter Cronkite at the Tet Offensive, or live reporting about the Kennedy assassination.
The only way you can really tell that he's a bit freaked out is that he starts fidgeting with his glasses. He takes them off, he puts them on, he takes them off, he puts them on. And then when he finally makes the announcement, he has a moment in which he chokes up.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital.
And then as soon as that moment fades, he is back to being Walter Cronkite again. And then the other piece that I looked at was one that I vaguely remember seeing at the time, which was his reporting from Vietnam following the Tet Offensive. And this is the moment in which we popularly think that the American mood turned against Vietnam. And what I saw was Walter Cronkite dressed in a khaki jumpsuit, standing there just kind of droning on about the Tet Offensive. But what made it powerful wasn't any emotion he was showing. It was very pointed descriptions of what he had seen with no sugarcoating.
Okay, so then did you come around to our premise that something changed and it's most clearly exemplified by the coverage from Katrina?
As our use of TV became a 24-hour beast that we had to fill, I think there was just a natural progression towards emotionalism because television wants two things. It wants visuals, but it also wants emotion. And so I'm not so sure what we saw from Smith and Cooper was something new, but Katrina offered them a moment to complete a historical arc that we were heading towards anyway.
The arc being what?
From a time when a middle-aged, gray-haired man wearing a khaki one-piece jumpsuit can be standing in the middle of a war zone and America thinks of him as the most trusted man in America and that that report is powerful and interesting and compelling, to a point where to be powerful and interesting and compelling, Anderson Cooper has to lose his cool and yell at a politician. Shepard Smith has to have an emotional breakdown.
So if Katrina did something that was inevitable, it also did something that audiences hadn't seen before, which was show ostensibly level-headed reporters suddenly becoming unglued. They became victim surrogates, and as anger mounted at the lack of federal response, they became audience surrogates. What's gained and what's lost when reporting changes like that?
Well, I wanted to kind of condemn it. But if you're going to do television well, you've got to feed the beast what it wants. And you take that and add in a disaster like Katrina, and I think you have the makings of a liberating moment for television journalism. In other words, a moment where we can say, okay, you know what? This is pissing me off. And it's pissing me off not necessarily because I'm a journalist. It's pissing me off because I'm a human being. I am a citizen of, you know, the richest, most powerful country in the world. Where is my country? And while on one hand that seems inappropriate for a journalist to be thinking, they're there on the ground. They're seeing the pain.
Well, here's the thing. They've always been there on the ground, and television has been there a very long time. Mm-hmm. What I see here is a very full expression of what many media watchers have noted for a long time, which is that the voices from on high, the Walter Cronkites and the Eric Severides of the world, have given way to a more level playing field. So now the reporters aren't instructing us. In these situations, they appear to be representing us. So what does the audience take away from that?
Whether or not it's a good thing or a bad thing, I think, is going to depend entirely on the American public's willingness to critically think about what they are seeing and hearing on television. Because the fact of the matter is, if Anderson Cooper can yell, basically, at a politician during the coverage of Katrina, like he did, you know, we can complain about the ethics of the purveyors of various media products, but we also have to ask ourselves hard questions about our own ethical choices in what we consume.
But isn't it perhaps okay if we acknowledge openly that what we really want from our journalists is a representative? Because that has always been the case. When people are enraged at a reporter, it's because the reporter doesn't agree with them, mm-hmm. not because the reporter is distorting information or lying to them.
Yes, it has always been the case. I mean, that's where American journalism started. I mean, papers were owned by politicians or owned by factions or heavily influenced by them. And it wasn't until we get into the penny press in the 1830s that that begins to change. And it isn't until the Progressive Era when it really completely changes. That whole idea of objectivity, if what is meant by that is some strange ability to stand outside of events and tell you how it actually is, has always been nonsense. So I agree that people want news that generally conforms to their worldviews. Now, do they want emotional surrogates out there? I think it's entirely possible for some viewers, if you're sitting there frustrated.
Howard Beale.
Well, Howard Beale. And that's exactly what happens in Network. When I watched Network for the first time, I considered it fantasy. It's turned out to be a prophecy.
Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Andrew Klein is Associate Professor of Journalism at Missouri State University.
I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, and Brett Jaspers, with more help from Nerida Brownlee and Bonnie Watt, and edited by Brooke. Jennifer Munson has temporarily left us to have a baby. Good luck, Jen. We miss you already. Our engineer this week was Robert Granis, with help from John Delore. A special thank you to WNYC archivist Andy Lancet.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs and our head honcho. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.